This episode of Metatrex is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and to help Trek FM at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program of the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. Want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
This is Tim Russ, Lieutenant Commander Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
There's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy.
My philosophy is that there is room for all philosophies on this station.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 91 of Metatrex, Trek FM show on Star Trek and philosophy. My name is Zachary Frueling, and with me, as always, is Mike Morrison. Today, we are going to be discussing equality in the Star Trek universe. Mike, good evening. How are you?
I'm doing well, Zachary.
Well, you picked the topic for today's episode, equality in the Star Trek universe, which is something I haven't thought about very much about Star Trek. Principally because I think Star Trek kind of assumes equality between races, between cultures, between individuals. Mm-hmm. The baseline assumption seems to be equality. So I'm curious what about Star Trek and equality put this on your radar for talking about today?
Well, it's interesting because I had actually had a debate of sorts with a friend of mine, a philosophical debate, Zachary, in which we were talking about equality in our own world. And interestingly enough, he was a Star Trek fan, and we started talking about the Star Trek universe and the world that the universe, rather, that humans live in the 23rd, 24th century. And I thought it was very interesting because a lot of his viewpoints on equality, and he used that phrase that we're all familiar with, all men are created equally. But yet I was able to make an interesting case, not that I don't believe that all men are created equally, but I find it interesting in our own world today, and I think it's true also in the Star Trek universe, that all men may be created equally, but not everyone is the same. So I got to thinking about, for instance, red shirts. What makes them expendable? And what makes Captain Picard, for instance, any better candidate to be a captain than, say, Dr. Crusher? So I thought that would make an interesting conversation for you and I to have.
Well, given that equality is something I haven't spent a lot of time thinking about, when in doubt, philosophers make a distinction. So I think we need to start out by thinking about what kind of equality we're talking about. Are we talking about political equality, moral equality, equality under the law? Do people have equal abilities, equal opportunities, equal rights? So there are a number of different directions we can take the discussion, depending on which of those you find most interesting or most problematic in the Star Trek universe.
I think it's worth kind of giving a high-level overview of those different senses of equality, those different types of equality, and then we can bring it into the Star Trek universe. And, you know, for instance, we've had conversations about red shirts. We've had conversations about bots and AI and so on. So I thought it would be interesting to kind of pull tidbits, really, of sorts of many conversations that you and I have had here on this podcast and bring them into this conversation and discuss.
I think a corollary to that first question, equality in what sense, is who counts as equal? Which sphere of being should we consider to be equal under any one of those senses of equality? All life forms, only the sentient life forms, only the higher level sentient life forms. And we have many examples of these inside the Star Trek universe. So it'll be interesting to kind of go through each of these types of equality, moral equality, equal rights, equal abilities, and see which beings count in the sphere that we think that sense of equality applies to.
I think it's fascinating the attitudes. Let's begin with political equality. I think it's fascinating as we examine the different iterations of Star Trek. For instance, in the original Star Trek series, there seemed to be less a sense of respect for other cultures, other political ideals within the Star Trek universe. However, once we get to Star Trek The Next Generation and some of the more modern iterations, it seems that there is a more evolved opinion of the political conditions that exist within other cultures. For instance, the way United Federation of Planets citizens look at the Romulan Empire, or look at the Klingon Empire, or look at the Bajoran home world, look at the Cardassians, for instance, there seems to be a more evolved opinion, whereas you have in the original Star Trek almost a loathing for the political conditions of these other worlds.
Well, Captain Kirk seems to loathe pretty much everything. He loathes the Klingons, but he also loathes and is a destroyer of utopias. Right? Anytime there's a supposed utopia where, you know, there's a computer taking care of the population, or all of the free will has been taken away for the for the sake of having a sort of utopian society, Captain Kirk is the first one to come in with a sledgehammer and destroy it all.
That's a great point. And that really seems counterintuitive to the attitudes, at least, that we get in more modern iterations of Star Trek.
Yeah, Captain Picard is much more hands-off. You know, he seems to have some sort of aesthetic respect for the differences between cultures, whereas Captain Kirk is much more of a homogenizing force, taking Federation values and the Federation political system, the view of what a healthy society looks like, and being willing to impose that, for lack of a better word, on other cultures, or at least getting other cultures to see the light themselves for Federation values and ideals.
And Captain Picard was very much the same way in Star Trek The Next Generation. He was just a bit more conservative about it. You know, he comes in and he finds a false deity reigning over, lording over, using, you know, these technologies to produce magic that, you know, sways the population into bowing down. And he's going to reveal that. He's going to out that. He's going to pull back the curtain and let him see what she's really made of. But you don't find him necessarily doing that every time he drops in on an away mission, just completely blowing up the political and social structure of a world that he visited.
You know what came to mind when I was thinking about political equality in Star Trek is the dinner scene in Star Trek VI, where the Klingons basically say the Federation is a Homo sapiens only club.
I think that's a great example.
So while the Federation may claim universality and tolerance, the perception, at least from the Klingons and possibly from other cultures out there in the galaxy, is that the Federation is not very tolerant and not very inclusive.
And the genius, I think, behind that scene is, I think in many ways, it sums up what, for those of us who are Star Trek fans, was really the $64,000 question. In terms of why was there so much tension necessarily between Klingons and the Federation, because we really didn't understand where those tensions come from. We were just presented this warrior class culture, and they didn't like us very much. And frankly, we didn't like them very much either. But I think that scene was really revealing in a lot of ways. It kind of exposed these underlying feelings and impressions that they had, and really opens up kind of this political conversation about how other cultures view one another.
Well, as we're diving in, it feels like there are two aspects to this. One aspect is what equality means within the Federation. Is the Federation as equal opportunity as it touts itself to be? And the second aspect is, what is the relationship between the Federation's view of equality and other cultures' view of equality? Is the Federation tolerant of other cultures that don't share equality as a value? Even if the Federation misses the mark sometimes in the way that the Klingons accuse them of, should they be and are they tolerant of other cultures' views on equality? You know, is there a problem of relativism as it relates to other cultures and equality?
I think what I find most interesting to answer your question is the actions of someone like Ambassador Spock, who's willing to risk his own life to infiltrate Romulus in the hopes of bringing some kind of help and hope to a handful of rebels who are trying to bring about change to the Romulan homeworld. So to answer your question, I think by and large, the Federation is very open and very tolerant. However, we don't always see that on screen. We see as much bigotry and bias, I think, in the Federation as we do other cultures within the Star Trek universe.
I was just thinking of Captain Picard in Star Trek Nemesis in the scene where he's having dinner with Shinzon on the floor of the Romulan Senate chamber, when mm-hmm. Captain Picard basically says that the Federation's highest hope is that all cultures, all races can be united, in common interests, whether they're political interests or scientific interests or cultural interests, whatnot, peacefully united in some way. I think that captures the Federation's ideal in terms of equality. I guess the interesting question is how to do that in a way that's not homogenizing.
And I think that's terribly difficult. I think it's difficult to answer within the Star Trek universe. I think it's a difficult problem, period. And I don't think we have to look into the Star Trek universe. I think we see plenty of that in our own. It's a very difficult undertaking to bridge those gaps.
Well, let's move on to talk about a different sense of equality. Let's talk about moral equality. I think it's a given in the Federation that at least some other beings out there, non-human beings, are entitled to the same moral equality as human beings. Here we tend to think, here in the real world on Earth right now, we tend to think that all humans are entitled to the same degree of moral equality. Sometimes mm-hmm. we fall short of that, but at least that's our ideal. It remains to be seen what exactly that means, moral equality in what sense. Do we treat them like Kantians do, respecting their autonomy? Do we treat them like utilitarians do, trying to maximize happiness for the greatest number of people? But regardless, we think that all humans are generally entitled to the same degree of moral equality in some sense. And I think it's a given that some aliens out there in the Star Trek universe are entitled to the exact same degree of moral equality that humans are entitled to. But I think it's an interesting question what exactly that means. Which aliens are entitled to moral equality and which are not? Some are humanoid, some are not. Some are sentient, some are not. Some have a higher degree of intelligence than others. Some have specialized abilities, or some are silicon-based, whilst others are carbon-based. There's mm-hmm. a huge diversity of life in the Star Trek universe.
Sure.
Which of those should be entitled to moral consideration, and for what reasons? I think that's the interesting philosophical question. What grounds granting another type of being, besides humans, which we obviously assent to, moral equality or moral entitlement?
I think that's a great question. And I think we see a ton of examples of this within the Star Trek universe. First of all, I think Star Trek is extremely interested in identifying sentience. And that seems to be one particular factor that's taken into consideration when we talk about moral equality. But beyond that, even sentience isn't necessarily the end-all be-all for giving that type of consideration to a species. Let's take, for example, the Borg. Let's take, for example, species 8472. I think of the crystalline entity. I am always taken back by the sheer shock, the disgust that was exhibited on the bridge of the Enterprise when the crystalline entity was destroyed. Even though it seemed hostile, they were willing to give that creature the same moral considerations that they would have given any species. And I find that fascinating. And I find that telling about what an evolved being is capable of.
I think there's a lot to unpack here. You mentioned sentience, and to me that calls to mind Kantian moral theory, which is that any being that is intelligent, sentient, self-aware, with its own purposes and aims, in other words, a being that we would call a free agent in the world, is entitled to moral consideration. And some of these in the Star Trek universe are incontrovertible. Klingons, they're obviously sentient beings with their own aims and purposes and entitled to moral consideration in that Kantian sense, because they have the same degree of autonomy as we do. Same thing with Romulans, same thing with Vulcans. Okay, those are all the clear-cut cases. Those races are obviously entitled to moral consideration. But I think the interesting thing to do is to consider the edge cases. And you mentioned a few of these. What about the non-humanoid life forms like the crystalline entity? That's a great example. It's possibly sentient. It seems to communicate in a way we don't fully understand. We don't know. It's almost like the what it's like to be a bat problem, right? What's it like to be a crystalline entity? We don't know if it's really sentient or not. Right. All we can do is try to, you know, make it resonate and see if we can communicate with it, do, you know, space Morse code with it. But what's interesting, especially in Star Trek The Next Generation, Captain Picard almost always gives alien beings that are possibly sentient or maybe sentient or not quite sentient or almost sentient the benefit of the doubt. When there's an open question whether a being is sentient or not, Captain Picard tends to extend the concept of sentience to them, almost erring on the side of caution. It's better to extend the concept of sentience to a being that may or may not be sentient than to assume that a being is not sentient and risk violating that being's rights if it turns out it actually is sentient.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And there are a lot of these edge cases. I'm trying to think of a few. Even Data is kind of an edge case. In The Measure of a Man, we don't really know if Data is sentient or not. Is he a being? Is he self-aware? Is he conscious? They go through these different permutations and these different ways of talking about whether Data is sentient or not in the course of the hearing to determine the status of Data as property or as an autonomous being. But in that episode, Captain Picard basically makes that argument that, well, we don't know for sure, so we better err on the side of caution. And that's kind of where the discussion is left at the end of the day. I'm trying to think of other examples from Star Trek The Next Generation, because I think Star Trek The Next Generation has a few of these. One that comes to mind is the spaceborne life form in Galaxy's Child, where this spacefaring being gives birth and the baby latches onto the Enterprise and thinks the Enterprise is its mother. In that episode, it's not totally clear whether the space baby that latches onto the Enterprise is sentient or not. Will it be sentient when it grows up? We don't really know. But Captain Picard at least decides to take the alien home rather than shoot it with the phasers.
Right.
So Captain Picard seems to be extending it some sort of moral courtesy, if not moral equality. Can you think of other examples that are what you might consider edge cases for sentience in The Next Generation or other iterations of Star Trek?
The episode that comes to my mind, Zachary, is actually a Deep Space Nine episode. It's, I believe, a second season episode, Playing God, in which this baby galaxy is forming inside Deep Space Nine. And they actually have this kind of moral debate. You know, do we just destroy it? It's us or them, somebody says in that conversation. I don't recall who. But basically says, you know, it's us or them. Let's just destroy it now. And they likened it to stepping on ants. And I love what Odo says. He turns and he says, I don't step on ants. And at the end of the episode, they end up figuring out a very risky way to take this galaxy through the wormhole. Arjun, the Trill Initiate, and Jadzia Dax take it through the wormhole, where I don't know how it's going to affect the Gamma Quadrant any differently than it's going to affect the Alpha Quadrant, but somehow in the Gamma Quadrant it's able to expand and function without destroying the galaxy. So they come up with a resolution at the end that doesn't involve destroying this galaxy, and I find that episode again very telling about the attitudes of the Federation towards even emerging life.
I think another example might be the whales in Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home. We know that whales are intelligent in some sense. They communicate with each other. We don't know what their consciousness is like, obviously, but they display certain characteristics of intelligence and, you know, certain qualities that make them more similar to us than similar to a bacterium. But does that make them entitled to moral equality? You know, that's an interesting case. You know, should they be extended the right to vote? Should their aims and their goals and purposes, their cetacean desires and their cetacean purposes be taken into account? Should we respect those to the same degree that we respect, you know, the autonomy of humans or Vulcans or Romulans or Klingons?
Cetacean equality, it's a thing in the 24th century.
I guess the point I'm driving home is that it's not obvious at all that sentience is the characteristic that conveys moral consideration. An equally likely candidate for the quality that conveys moral consideration is the ability to feel pain or to suffer. If we can prevent a being suffering, whether or not it's sentient, whether or not it's intelligent, whether or not it has these sort of higher level human-like characteristics that Kant... And the Federation seems to latch onto. You can look at the diversity of life here on Earth and in the Star Trek universe out there in the galaxy. Not all those beings are intelligent or sentient in a strong sense, but some of them are at least aware enough to be able to suffer or to be able to feel pain. And if we can prevent that, aren't those beings entitled to moral consideration in the sense of trying to prevent their pain and suffering?
Yeah, and I appreciate the foresight that we often see within the Star Trek universe, that we not only consider the present situation, but we also take into consideration the future evolution of a species, of a culture, of a life form. And I think that's important as well, to step back and consider the future potential of that life form when we're trying to determine the measure of equality that we're willing to attribute to that life form.
See, that's a strange concept, though, because every life form has future potential, right? You know, mm-hmm. Humans weren't always around. We evolved from something that came before us, and that species evolved from something that came before it, all the way back to the primordial ooze, or the beginning of life, as Q pointed out in All Good Things. You can look at any species from the bacterium on up and say, well, that species has potential in the course of millions or billions or trillions of years that might evolve into something that has the potential for sentience. Is that a slippery slope to bacterium rights?
Well, I think Q thinks so, because he certainly was willing to tip the scales a little bit to help Jean-Luc out in All Good Things.
Can you imagine what elections would be like if every bacterium had the ability and right to vote? They would outnumber us, you know, zillionfold.
Most certainly, most certainly. And don't even get me started on the insects.
I guess what I'm trying to say is there has to be a dividing line somewhere. There are obvious candidates for sentience or beings that are entitled to moral consideration in the Kantian sense. Humans, Klingons, Vulcans, Romulans, and Cardassians, and everyone else, all the humanoid life forms in Star Trek. Then there are the edge cases, the ones that we're not quite sure if they're sentient or not. We don't exactly know what it's like to be that species. They display some signs of intelligence, but we're not really sure, or we have to communicate with them in a different way. They're at least plausibly intelligent enough to where we could extend to where we could extend equality in the Kantian sense to those beings, give them the benefit of the doubt, as Captain Picard does. And then there's everything else below, right? The animal life forms, the Targs and the Vulcan pets and whatever they're called. What are they called? I feel like I should know this.
Oh,
Saylot, right?
Saylot. Yeah.
Right. Are they entitled to moral consideration in the Kantian sense? I think that gets less and less plausible the farther down the evolutionary chain you go anywhere in the galaxy. So there has to be a cutoff point. And I think Captain Picard is very conservative and basically says, we're going to extend this notion of rights and this notion of equality in the Kantian sense downward a little bit, even though it's a little fuzzy where we're going to draw the cutoff line. But the problem that I see is that if beings are entitled to moral consideration in a different sense, in the sense of being able to suffer or feel pain, where it's part of our moral responsibility to prevent those beings from suffering, that it seems like you can extend further and further and further down the evolutionary chain. Like mm-hmm. lower life forms can still feel pain, so they're entitled to us taking into account their ability to suffer and prevent their suffering. This is why we have the concept of animal rights here on Earth. And mm-hmm. presumably there's something like a 24th century equivalent of animal rights. You know, whatever random, you know, life form you come across out there in the galaxy, presumably it's at least entitled not to suffer. That doesn't mean it gets the right to vote. It doesn't mean it has its own aims and purposes. So different senses of equality may not apply. But in the sense of moral equality, I think it's at least plausible that you can extend that second sense of moral equality all the way down to wherever the cutoff is for being able to experience pain and suffering. Can a bacterium experience pain and suffering? We don't really know. It certainly seems to react negatively to certain stimuli, right? You know, bacteria will gravitate away from certain things and move towards certain things. Does that mean they're sentient? Does that mean they can experience things? Does that mean there's any awareness whatsoever? I don't think anyone can really answer that question at this point. Maybe they've answered that in the 24th century. I have no idea. But I think there has to be a cutoff point somewhere, even for that second sense of moral equality. Although, I guess it's possible. Maybe extremely low life forms have some proto-sensory experience that allows them to experience something like suffering. Maybe we should worry about using penicillin or the 24th century equivalent. When Dr. Crusher gives a hypospray, do we have to worry about the moral entitlement of the bacteria she's eliminating and its ability to experience pain and suffering?
Yeah, I think if Captain Picard were here, he would say, the line must be drawn here, this far, and no further.
I think that's it. For both senses of moral equality that we've talked about, the Kantian sense and what I would call the utilitarian sense, the sense of trying to eliminate pain and suffering, it seems like there's a classic line drawing problem. There are clear-cut cases on mm-hmm. either side, you know, clearly sentient beings, clearly not sentient beings, beings that can clearly experience pain and suffering, and other beings that clearly don't experience pain and suffering. And there's this huge gray area in the middle. And the problem is, if you don't draw a semi-arbitrary, semi-gray line in the middle somewhere, you end up having to extend those concepts of moral equality all the way down to some sort of potentially absurd consequence, like granting bacteria rights.
Yeah. And frankly, I don't think we necessarily take the pain and suffering, at least in the world that we live in, I don't think we necessarily take pain and suffering into consideration. You mentioned Dr. Crusher's hypospray. In our own modern world, just, you know, going to the doctor and getting a flu shot, for instance.
No, I don't worry about the moral implications of calling the exterminator if I have an insect problem, right? That's just not something we worry about. Maybe we should. Maybe that's a moral failing of humans. Maybe that will be different in the 24th century. Maybe 24th century entomologists will discover that insects are more sentient than we give them credit for here today, or that they can experience pain and suffering more than we give them credit for here today. And maybe a more evolved view of extremely lower life forms will emerge in the 24th century. I don't know. It doesn't seem like it in the Star Trek universe, though. It does seem like the higher level and mid-grade beings get, if not full moral consideration, then at least the benefit of the doubt. But lower life forms, they don't seem to be entitled to moral consideration. But that doesn't mean that we try to exterminate them. I think throughout Star Trek, you see examples of extremely lower level life forms maybe not being given full moral consideration in the sense of moral equality, but at least being given the right to survive, the right to exist. I can envision Captain Picard saying, you know, the nanites in that TNG episode Evolution. Evolution?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I can imagine Captain Picard in that TNG episode Evolution, where nanites take over the Enterprise, basically saying they have the same right to exist that we do. They're part of the universe just as much as we are. That doesn't mean they're sentient. That doesn't mean that they can experience pain and suffering. Maybe they can in that episode, but at least they're entitled to exist, right? And I'm not sure if that's the same thing as moral consideration, the right to exist, just, you know, being part of the universe and having the right to exist. Does that mean you're entitled to full moral consideration in the way that humans and sentient beings and higher level beings that can experience pain and suffering do? I'm not sure that those really mean the same thing, but I think throughout Star Trek, you can see that lower life forms are at least given enough moral consideration to where they're granted the right to exist just as much as humans are.
We've muddied the water a little bit here between moral equality and equal rights, equality under the law. I think we have a pool here that we've created, I think, that's kind of encompassing these concepts. But I think that there's a lot of concourse anyway when we're talking about moral rights, equality under the law, and equal rights. I think there's a great deal of concourse there. And I think we can even take this concept and apply it to even something I think that maybe perhaps a little bit more controversial. And that would be, for instance, the character Tuvix, the creature, the creation that was a merger of Tuvok and Neelix. What, for instance, I guess my question is, made him any less protected under this idea of equality under the law, equal rights? Why did we not give him the same moral equality that in those considerations that we gave to Tuvok and Neelix?
Yeah, that's an interesting case because there are really three beings in question there. There's Tuvok, the Vulcan, Neelix, the Talaxian, and the hybrid of the two, Tuvix. All three of them can experience pain and suffering, so they're entitled to full moral consideration on the utilitarian theory. All three of them seem to be fully self-aware and sentient and autonomous, so they are entitled to moral consideration under the Kantian theory. There's a numbers consideration. There's a two versus one consideration in the utilitarian sense, right? There's Tuvok and Neelix, two of them versus Tuvix, the one. Mm-hmm. So on a utilitarian moral theory, you can say, well, two outrank one. You know, it's two individuals suffering versus one individual.
Needs of the many
suffering.
Outweigh the needs of the few.
Exactly.
Or the one.
So Tuvok and Neelix outweigh Tuvix. But there's something dissatisfying about that. We want to say that Tuvix is entitled to the same moral consideration as either one of the other two, right? Mm-hmm. He's fully self-aware in the Kantian sense. He's fully able to experience pain and suffering, so he's entitled to full moral consideration. So he's entitled to rights under Federation law, so he has equality under the law just as much as Tuvok and Neelix. So where does Captain Janeway get off choosing Tuvok and Neelix over Tuvix? There's a third possibility that we haven't talked about, which is the ethics of care, right? The relationship between Captain Janeway and Tuvok and Captain Janeway and Neelix, the kind of intrafamilial relationship they have on Voyager, is, you could say, that's morally relevant. That you know, there's a reason we tend to care for our own family members and loved ones and friends more than we care for, you know, random people that we don't know. Mm-hmm. And on that view, the ethics of care, that those special relationships matter morally in some way. So you could appeal to a completely different moral theory that says, well, when we're talking about moral consideration, you might be justified saving your friends versus saving a random stranger if push came to shove. But I think there's something dissatisfying about that if you're attracted to the Kantian view of ethics that relies on sentience and autonomy, or if you're attracted to the utilitarian sense of ethics that emphasizes the lack of pain and suffering.
Yeah, and I think for our listeners who perhaps feel that Tuvix got a bum rap, I think the argument is that the needs of the many in this case is a moral cop-out.
Well, I think Tuvix is an interesting edge case. I think it's less of an edge case than the whales in Star Trek IV, and less of an edge case than nanites, and less of an edge case than the space baby in Star Trek The Next Generation. But it is an interesting question whether Tuvix is a fully sentient autonomous being, even though he's a hybrid of Tuvok and Neelix. Is he a fully realized distinct being, or is it really like Tuvok and Neelix, you know, smushed together inside of his mind in some way? You know, is it really Tuvok and Neelix in there, or is there a separate being called Tuvix? We don't really know, because we just have this being Tuvix in front of us who talks and says things and expresses things, and we don't really know what it's like to be Tuvix any more than we know what it's like to be a whale in Star Trek IV, and any more than we know what it's like to be a nanite. But if Tuvix is a fully autonomous being, then it seems like he should be entitled to the same moral consideration as either Tuvok or Neelix. So I think that's an interesting edge case, because we don't get too many humanoid edge cases in Star Trek, right? All the edge cases morally seem to be the mid-grade and lower-level life forms that may or may not be sentient, or may or may not experience pain and suffering, that we may or may not care about in the way that Vulcans care about their pet Salots, right? But we don't get too many human edge cases, but we do get a lot of these here in the real world. Like, if we're going to emphasize sentience for moral consideration, there are lots of beings that are humans here in the real world that aren't fully sentient, right? They're disabled in some way, or they're in a coma, or fill in the blank, right? We still extend moral consideration to them, even though they don't seem sentient or sentient anymore or fully realized in some way. Same thing in the Star Trek universe. You know, if someone comes into sickbay and, you know, ends up in a coma, are they sentient? Well, not anymore, but we still extend the moral consideration. So I think it's really easy to overemphasize sentience as the bearer of moral consideration, even in Star Trek, even as much as Starfleet and the Federation go out in search of sentient life forms.
Yeah. And I think there's a dark underbelly to this question as well. This conversation that we're having, I think that emphasizes this idea of these types of moral considerations going to the point of exploitation. And I think we see a lot of really good examples. For instance, Encounter at Farpoint, I think, is a great example of that type of exploitation of a life form. Captain Ransom comes to mind from Voyager. I think of the tardigrade in Star Trek Discovery. So there are these examples of these creatures, and we can call them lower life forms, sure, but I don't think Star Trek, in most of these cases, gives us any definitive answers as to whether or not these are sentient beings. But we're outraged when we see a creature exploited. And I think that's the dark underbelly of this conversation that we're having where it pertains to equality.
Well, I think the reason that it's dissatisfying is sometimes the episodes in question don't actually answer the question, right? They'll sure. show a life form that may or may not be sentient. It's different enough from humanoid life forms where it's not totally clear. The Horta comes to mind. Right?
Yes,
you know, Horta are
a great example.
They're radically non-humanoid, but they display some characteristics of intelligence. They display some characteristics of empathy. We don't know what it's like to be a Horta, but they're close enough. And in that episode, it really is answered. But like the example that you mentioned from Voyager, Equinox, where Captain Ransom is basically torturing and killing these non-humanoid life forms and using them for fuel. The episode doesn't really answer whether they're sentient or super intelligent. It leaves it kind of vague what these life forms are really like. And I think you're right. If you don't err on the side of caution, if you don't extend moral consideration down the evolutionary chain a little bit, at least to the mid-grade life forms, if not to the lower-grade life forms, or the radically different life forms, you know, on wherever they happen to lie on their particular evolutionary scale, then you end up with the potential for exploitation. If you don't view another being as entitled to moral consideration, you can use that being for your own purposes in the Kantian sense of using another being as a means to your own ends versus respecting that being's ends, you know, as ends in themselves. And this is the reason I think Captain Picard errs on the side of caution, you know, almost without fail every time he encounters a radically different type of life form where it's not totally clear whether that being is fully sentient or not, or fully aware or not, or fully able to experience pain and suffering or not. Captain Picard will err on the side of caution and say, well, we better leave it alone and make sure we don't hurt the thing.
Yes. And Zachary, I think we're touching on one of our other major questions here, and that is who counts as equal. But before we go there, there is one type of equality I want to touch on, and I think for a very important reason, and that is equal opportunity. There's a really great example of this in Deep Space Nine, in which we're given a character, Melora Pazler, who in all fairness has what you and I would consider perhaps a disability. She's from a planet with low gravity, and it's difficult for her to function in what we would consider normal gravity. And so I actually had a conversation a couple of years ago with a friend of mine who has a disability and is a Star Trek fan, loves this episode because, hello, representation. This was a character who was three-dimensional, flesh and blood, functioning within the Star Trek universe and contributing to the Federation, having a disability. And my friend especially appreciates this episode. And there are other examples. For instance, we have Captain Pike, who I think is presented in the Prime universe as opposed to the Kelvin universe in a somewhat different way. But, you know, a character there that has a disability. We're given occasions within the Star Trek universe of characters who are disabled in some way or another. Geordi, I think, is probably one of the most prominent examples with his blindness, and how even with his visor, there are times when he is at a disadvantage. And so I think these are important characterizations within the Star Trek universe that gives those who have disability a chance to cheer on someone that they can identify with and say, you know what, even though I have A, B, or C, or I'm not able to do X, Y, or Z, I'm still someone of intrinsic value who can contribute to the betterment of my society.
I think it's a brute force fact that different individuals and different races inside the Star Trek universe have different innate abilities. Sometimes it's because of a disability like Geordi that you mentioned. Sometimes it's a result of certain physical characteristics that a particular species has and whatnot. It's interesting to ask the question about what the relationship is between the brute force fact of the differences between abilities and the equality of opportunity that you describe. Geordi's a great example because it highlights the futurism element of Star Trek, right? Mm-hmm. Geordi has more opportunity because of his visor, right? I think it's almost more interesting to ask what would Geordi's equality of opportunity have been if he hadn't had the visor, right? If Federation technology hadn't advanced to the point where they were able to overcome, you know, his blindness that he was born with, would he have had the same equality of opportunity? Would they have found some other way for him to be a chief engineer or to be a helmsman or to be whatever other job he's had in Starfleet? It's interesting you mentioned M'Laura from Deep Space Nine, because there's an example of someone who's disabled where the disability hasn't been overcome in the way that Geordi's has, and we mm-hmm. see it overcome a bit inside the episode. What view should we have about equality of opportunity in those cases where either we're talking about disabled individuals where the disability hasn't been overcome with technology, like it has for Geordi, or we're talking about innate differences between individuals or between species? I feel like it's a brute force fact that everyone should be able to strive for the same opportunities, even if they have differences in abilities. But that doesn't mean that those opportunities are going to come as easily to everyone, right? Someone like Geordi might have, if Geordi didn't have his visor, he might have to work really, really hard at figuring out how to be a chief engineer. But I don't think it's not that it's open to him. I just think he has to work harder at it. I don't know if we get a really great sense of how that is dealt with inside the Star Trek universe.
I think these are two really interesting case studies. In Geordi's case, it really, I think, stands as a testament of what I think is possible if we take on a problem and we solve it. In Geordi's case, it was the invention of his visor. It was this piece of technology that really, in many ways, didn't just bridge the gap between his disability and, you know, living to the fullest of his potential. Mm-hmm. I think to some degree it even gave him, as you said, an advantage. I think you brought that point out. And for us in our world today, I think it stands as a really important reminder that we need to be diligent to resolve problems, to solve problems in our own universe, to find ways to bridge the gaps between disability and living one's life to full potential. And I'm passionate about that because my own grandfather growing up, he was born blind. He got an infection when he was born. It affected his eyesight, and he lived his entire life, 90 some years, he lived completely blind. And in many ways, he saw things that you and I never will be able to see in the world. But I wonder what might have become of his life if we would have championed a way to give him sight.
Well, I think there are two things that come to mind. I'm wondering what the 24th century equivalent of the Americans with Disabilities Act is. To what extent are the Federation and Starfleet or any private enterprises in the 24th century responsible for providing accessibility to disabled people at large? A corollary to that question is the extent to which the Federation and Starfleet open doors of opportunity to disabled individuals in the way that those opportunities have been extended to Geordi and to M'Laura and to countless other disabled individuals in the Star Trek universe that we could probably come up with. So that's one thing, the status of disabled individuals in Star Trek and the equality of opportunity they do and should have in Star Trek. I think the more interesting question for me is the question about what to do about life forms that are sentient in the Kantian sense, but are radically different from us. If it turns out that cetaceans are fully sentient, should we allow them to serve in Starfleet? Should they be, you know, should there be a cetacean ops on the Enterprise D because of sentient whales, right? You know, in other words, if a whale wants to be a chief engineer on a starship, should we figure out a way to make it happen? You know, flood engineering with water, you know, build a...
We have something that looks like the Zindi aquatic ships.
Yeah, not just enclosing engineering in transparent aluminum like Scotty does in Star Trek IV, but you know, enclose it in transparent aluminum and give the whale a uniform.
Standard issue.
Another example might be the Shellyak in Star Trek The Next Generation. Mm-hmm. They're obviously sentient. They're communicative. They have a legal system. But they're not humanoid. So if one of them wants to join Starfleet and serve on a Federation starship, should it be allowed to? What special accommodations are made? What modifications do we make to its quarters? What accessibility features do we provide them at their workstation? We could run this with countless other life forms in Star Trek. The Horda. What if the Horda wants to serve in Starfleet?
I think that would have been a fascinating development. That kind of brings us back to M'Lora, because what I find interesting is the lengths that they were willing to go to accommodate her. And this really brings me to my second point from earlier, and I'm really just restating what my friend and I discussed that day when we were discussing this character. One of the reasons why he really appreciates this character, even more so than Geordi. Geordi is an example of bridging the gap between disability and living to one's fullest potential. In M'Lora's case, her disability actually, at the end of the episode, becomes her ability. She is able to overcome a life and death situation because of her disability. And she chooses to live as she is rather than accept Dr. Bashir's treatment to make her quote-unquote normal. And so for people out there who may be living with disabilities and there are not necessarily scientific breakthroughs that are bridging those gaps, I give you this character, M'Lora, who just really lived to her fullest potential despite her disability. And I think she's a great example of what it means to really live to one's fullest potential, regardless of the obstacles.
I'm wondering, and maybe this is just a little bit cynical sounding, but I'm wondering if they rolled out the red carpet for M'Lora so much because she was a specialist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if she didn't already have specialized knowledge or specialized abilities, would they have been so accommodating without that?
Well, and that really is, I think, an element of this conversation that we need to have. And so that kind of brings us to this idea that, okay, if all men are created equally in the Star Trek universe, they're certainly not all the same. For instance, to my original question, what makes Captain Picard so special to be a Starfleet captain? M'Lora being a specialist, is that the reason why they were willing to go to all of these lengths, this chair and the anti-grav system in her quarters, et cetera, et cetera? Do we give the same special accommodations to someone who comes through who's just a low-level contractor?
Yeah, everyone who's different in the Star Trek universe. Exactly, yeah. Right. It's almost a line-drawing problem again in a different kind of way.
I mean, would we have done that for, you know, John Q. Public from...
I think we need to make a distinction between the Federation and Starfleet in this case. Starfleet is the military organization of the Federation, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think it's totally reasonable to say that the military will only make so many accommodations.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say.
That generally it's expected that people will take their differences and abilities and fall in line, and they'll naturally gravitate towards certain careers or certain positions or certain roles. But the military will only go so far to make accommodations, right? Maybe Starfleet goes above and beyond in that regard in the 24th century. But I think it's still plausible, even in the 24th century, to say, look, we're still a military organization. There are certain needs that need to be met. And if you just plain can't do the job, then you're not going to have that role. No matter how hard you try, no matter what technology is used to make up for the deficiency, no matter how hard you work at it, no matter how much people like you, you know, that they'll still only go so far. And I think I do think that in the 24th century, Starfleet seems pretty accommodating. You know, I mean, Geordi's a great example. M'Lora is a great example. I think M'Lora is actually a better example than Geordi in this case, because Geordi is almost not just overcome his deficiency, he superseded it in some way with his visor. So maybe Geordi's not the greatest example. I think M'Lora is probably a better example in this case. Whereas I'm curious about the status of Federation society at large in the 24th century. To what degree are disabled individuals able to flourish and thrive and have equal opportunities? To what degree are their disabilities accommodated for? And same question for beings that are radically different, non-humanoid. You know, if an intelligent whale wants to go eat at Cisco's in New Orleans, right? To what extent is Captain Cisco's father obligated to, you know, figure out a way to make a whale eat at its restaurant? It sounds absurd, but those are the questions that would come up in a radically diverse society in the 24th century when you have non-humanoid sentient beings.
Well, all I know is if that whale has anything besides the gumbo, it's wasting its time.
Mm-hmm.
get that whale some gumbo.
Get that whale some gumbo. So, obviously Starfleet is the military arm of the Federation. The military is hierarchical. There's a command structure. And I think it's plausible, if a little morally dissatisfying, to say that certain people matter more in that environment. The captain is going to matter more than a lower-level officer from the perspective of saving their life, following their orders, their wishes being taken into consideration. In that rigidly hierarchical structure, the captain's life is going to matter more than Joe Redshirt.
Yeah, I agree completely. And frankly, that brings me to, I think, one of the more interesting and perhaps controversial command decisions I think ever made in the Star Trek universe. And that comes from the 7th season episode, Thine Own Self, when Deanna Troi realizes that in order to do the right thing in a position of command, she has to put the ship first and order Geordi to his death. I think that's very interesting because I think it comes down to what's Geordi's life worth as opposed to another ranking engineer, maybe someone else who works in engineering that perhaps isn't as valuable as Geordi. Why Geordi? And is Geordi's life more than that low-level engineer who probably could have gone and made that repair? Is there a better call to make? Those types of command calls are difficult to make, but every captain in the Star Trek universe realizes that there comes a moment when you've got a situation and you're going to order somebody to get into a transporter or jump onto a shuttlecraft and go off and die.
I guess I read that example a little differently. I read that example as Geordi being the only one who was able to fix the situation in that holodeck simulation.
And perhaps that's the case, but I think in a real situation, there probably were a dozen people that she could have ordered. I think that's just an example of the type of call I think that brings to mind this sense of the value of a person's life.
Well, you're almost describing like red shirt discrimination. Like every time you beam down someone in a red shirt, like they can go, hey, how come you're discriminating against me? How come you're not beaming the captain down here in this dangerous environment?
Without a doubt, I have to wonder if the first day of filming of Encounter at Farpoint, if all those command officers were looking at those uniforms when they were issued going, man.
Don't give me a red one. Don't give me a red one.
I thought this was going to be a long-term gig.
I think you could plausibly say, though, that when you enlist in Starfleet, no matter what role you end up having, you are voluntarily waiving some of your rights. Right, yeah. We do this all the time. I mean, that happens in the real military, and there are other specialized environments where you voluntarily waive some of your rights. I think that's what's going on here. That when you enlist in Starfleet, you are no longer entitled to, you know, to a right to life as we know it. Right, you might be ordered to a dangerous environment and killed. You might be ordered to sacrifice yourself for the greater good, like Geordi has to do in that simulation.
Zachary, it just occurred to me, I think we uncovered the actual reason Patrick Stewart did not unpack his bag for weeks after he started filming Star Trek The Next Generation. They issued him a red tunic.
So you're saying that when they started The Next Generation, Captain Picard was given a red shirt as a sign of democratic equality for red shirts in the 24th century, progress over the 23rd century.
Yeah, Patrick Stewart's looking back at the original series going, I'm not going to make it through an episode.
But Riker won't let him beam down, so.
And there you said it. Riker won't let him beam down. And that may be a Starfleet regulation, but again, I think it begs the question, why is the captain's life necessarily more important than anyone else's?
By extension, does that mean an admiral's life matters more than a captain's?
Why not?
Hmm.
And it's very dissatisfying to say that, you know, well, in the military, da-da-da-da-da-da. That's not very satisfying to just put it off in a military regulation or military rule. I think there's more to it. I think there needs to be more to it in a situation in which perhaps the captain is the best qualified to go, but it's a dangerous situation. So well,
that happens sometimes.
Captain Picard, like, you stay here.
There are a couple times when Captain Picard has to, you know, man a shuttlecraft because, you know, he feels it's his special duty or his special responsibility to take the risk in that case. So
yeah, and I there are certainly examples within the Star Trek universe, but I think it begs the question: why is one person's life more valuable than another?
One of the things I wanted to circle back to before we end the show is what our attitude should be about other cultures in the 24th century that mm-hmm. don't have the same sense of equality. This question of cultural relativism as it applies to equality. Certainly, the Federation has a high-minded view of these things. You know, whatever sense of moral equality it seems to hold. Sometimes it seems like it's a Kantian sense. Sometimes it seems like it's a utilitarian sense. But it seems to extend that very broadly. Mm-hmm. But the Federation also, at least in the 24th century, Captain Kirk is not like this because Captain Kirk is homogenizing and will and will you know destroy utopias and all the things that Captain Kirk does. But in the 24th century, at least, it's a little more evolved and there's a little more tolerance for radically different cultures. But what about cultures that themselves don't have a sense of equality? You know, if there were a 24th century world where there was radical discrimination or radical disparity in opportunity or disparity in social status, you know, should the Federation view that as infringing on the rights of the people that are being discriminated against, even though it's part of a different culture that we're trying to tolerate? It's a case of conflicting values, the universality of morality versus cultural tolerance.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure there is a lot to say about it, except for the fact that it seems like the Federation wants to have their cake and eat it too. They want to view their own moral views as being, I don't know, not superior, but at least universal, broadly applicable in some sense. But they also want to not be judgmental about other cultures and tolerant and let other cultures evolve on their own. And maybe it's just the view that if we let other cultures evolve, they will eventually evolve morally and end up seeing the universality of morality in the way that Federation worlds already do.
That seems to be, Zachary, the case, I think, by and large, in the Star Trek universe. I think it presents this idea that eventually every culture will come around and see things our way, so to speak, in irony quotes.
I think that's a pretty weak sense of cultural tolerance, though, if the view is that other cultures will eventually evolve to be like us.
I agree. I agree completely. And I think we're doing a better job of this in newer iterations of Star Trek, but I think, again, by and large, within the Star Trek universe, that's the attitude that I think we're presented within the Federation. So, Zachary, I think we have to ask the question here, what happens then in the Star Trek universe when values conflict? Do we arm photon torpedoes and blow them out of the sky? Do we sit down and in the ready room and have a conference and explain to them the values of the Federation in hopes that they'll buy in? What do we do here?
Captain Picard would have a board meeting. What are you talking about?
Captain Picard would have a board meeting. I think Captain Sisko would cook a pot of gumbo.
For whales and everyone else, yes.
For whales and everyone else. Well, Zachary, it's been fun talking about equality in the Star Trek universe today, but that isn't the only thing that we've been discussing here on the network. So here's a quick look, everyone, at some other things you may have missed elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, to the journey!
Brace for ideas. Okay, I'm going to make a commitment to myself right now. If I am ever perishing in a plane crash, I am going to say brace for impact right before I die to everyone on the plane.
I will
brace
somehow for impact. Hear it across the miles.
It'll be very dramatic, you know, with some dramatic theme music playing, hopefully, just like we have in Voyager here this episode.
Earl Grey.
That's terrible. Wow. Like, why would someone think that? I mean, if it's going to infect this entire world of Ferengi, you've got to assume that there's going to be visitors or whatever, and then it's just going to spread everywhere.
Spread
that
everywhere.
Doesn't even make sense.
Doesn't sound like a good plan.
No,
to me.
It does not.
Literary Treks.
Both Bound and myself like Star Trek stories that work as some kind of a parable that hold up the mirror to modern times. And when we got the assignment that we could actually write the Prometheus trilogy, we were pretty sure that we wanted to do something contemporary with it, that we wanted to put modern day into a science fiction story. And the biggest problem that we saw at the time was terrorism.
Melodic Treks.
You know, I suppose as being an actor, you know, I just was really kind of feeling into Clive's character. Okay. and trying to express the emotion of what I felt like he was going through on the Sarangi. Mm-hmm. So then it became much more of a personal, individual character. It was how I experienced doing it.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and join the conversation about your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button in Apple Podcasts on iPhone, iPad, Apple TV, or the desktop iTunes app to get the latest episodes as soon as they're published. And please, leave us a star rating and written review. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Google Play Music, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and most third-party apps. You can also stream and download the MP3 file from our website or grab the RSS link as well. Well, we'd love to hear your thoughts on today's show, and there are many ways for you to mind meld with us. And the best place to join the larger conversation is the Babel Conference, our listeners-only group on Facebook. Just type Babel, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and it should come right up. If you'd like to send us an email, you can use the contact form on our website at trek.fm/contact. Choose Message to a Trek FM Show and select Metatreks. That'll come right to us. You can also find the network on Twitter at TrekFM and on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. Well, Zachary, when you're not eating gumbo and considering the equality of the given universe, where can people find you on the interwebs and around the network?
Well, you can find me elsewhere on Trek.fm as co-host of To the Journey, Trek FM show dedicated to all things Star Trek Voyager. You can also find me in the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook, if you'd like to talk about Star Trek and philosophy with me in there. And you're welcome to follow me on Twitter. My handle is just my name, at Zachary Fruhling. That's Zachary, Z-A-C-H-A-R-Y, Fruhling, F-R-U-H-L-I. ING. And how about you, Mike? When you're not busy flooding engineering with salt water, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs and around the Trek FM network?
Well, Zachary, you can find me on Facebook. That's where I'm most active. I'm also on Twitter. My Twitter handle is at cmichael1701. I'm also on Instagram, cmichael1701. Well, if you'd like to keep all our shows coming to you each week, you can become a patron of the network on Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm. To get all the details, perks include early access to episodes, exclusive content, producer credits, and more. Available all through our special patrons website, Patron Zone. It requires a great deal of time and money to produce, host, and distribute these shows each month. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. And Zachary, we'd like to take a moment to acknowledge the rest of the Metatreks team from the network specifically. We'd like to thank C. Brian Jones, founder and publisher of Trek.fm. Our executive producers, Matthew Rushing and Ken Tripp. Art director, Aaron Harvey. Our production manager, Richard Marquez. And Brandon Shea Mutala, our Patreon manager. I'd like to give a special shout out to our associate producers, Patrick Devlin. You can connect with him on Twitter. His Twitter handle is at MagicDrop5. Kay Shaw, you can catch her on Twitter as well. At ChocoWeeble is her handle. Our good friend Norman Lau, his Twitter handle is at Starfighter1701. And Mark Walker, his Twitter handle is at Mark74656. And Zachary, we'd like to take one more opportunity to invite our listeners to discover more about our sponsor, Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society. Visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and to get your seat on the mission. And check out audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for your desktop or mobile device. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. Well, thanks everyone for listening to Metatrex, a Star Trek and philosophy podcast. Until next time, when we will once again boldly go where no philosophers or whales have gone before.